We're back. The worst blizzard in probably 20 years in Newfoundland history couldn't kill us motherfuckers. You're listening to They Came From the North, arguably the greatest Canadian podcast about movies and filmmakers.
Of all time.
Definitely the angriest.
At least the most cynical.
But it's not that cliche internet angry, though. This is genuine northern hops and malt-fueled anger. Bacon and maple syrup. We're coming at you live. Well, not live, because you're listening to a recording. Well, you know what I mean.
This recording was recorded in front of a live recording.
And we'll all self-destruct in 10 seconds.
The Game from the North was filmed in front of a live studio ostrich.
My cat is watching us.
Our cats consist of a live studio audience. I got two of them glaring at me right now, actually.
I missed last week's episode. Who do we do? Jean-Pierre Melville?
Yeah.
Well, this week we're going to do the complete opposite of the classic French director. I've been threatening it for months and months and months, and we're finally doing it. The object of They Came From the North this week is controversial crowd pleaser Michael Bay. Bay was born in Los Angeles, California in 1965, raised by his adoptive parents, a bookstore owner and child psychiatrist, and his father, a CPA. He got his start. I don't know what that is. Certified public accountant. Certified public accountant.
That sounds exciting.
Bay got his start in the film industry interning for George Lucas when he was 15 years old, following the storyboards for Raiders of the Lost Ark, which he admits thinking was going to be terrible. His opinion, which was wrong, by the way, changed immediately after seeing it in theater, and he was so impressed by the experience, he decided to become a director himself. After graduating from Wesleyan University in 1986, Bay began working at Propaganda Films, directing commercials and music videos, 2 weeks after finishing his postgraduate degree. His 92nd World War II-inspired Coca-Cola advertisement was picked up by Capitol Records, and his first national commercial for the Red Cross won an award in 1992. He also directed the first Got Milk advertisement. I'm sure everyone remembers that.
Remember!
Then moved on to several music videos. I believe Bay was actually the director of Meatloaf's comeback video for I'll Do Anything for Love.
I knew you were going to mention that.
Of course I was. Video's badass, man. Motorcycles and explosions. Music video was better than Bad Boys.
Wasn't he a ghost in that as well?
Oh, probably. Bay's success in music video gained the attentions of producers Jerry Bruckheimer and Don Simpson, who selected him to direct his first feature-length film, Bad Boys, starring, at the time, still the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, Will Smith, and Martin Lawrence, who I don't even think Martin Lawrence had his sitcom yet. I think he was still pretty much just a stand-up comedian.
He was, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think he may have been on, like, SNL or something like that.
And I think he was on one of the racier ones, one of the
Living
one of the
Color Fox. Or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Bad Boys proved to be a breakout film for all three of them. It was filmed for $19 million, grossed over $141 million at the box office in the spring of 1995. And the success of the movie actually started a very strong partnership between Bay and Jerry Bruckheimer. He followed it up in 1996 with The Rock. All anyone needs to really know about The Rock is that it pretty much breathed new life once again into Sean Connery's career and was successful enough to convince the world that Nicolas Cage could do action movies.
Oh, silly world.
The Rock was another huge success, and in 1998 led to Bay being given more money than he'd ever seen before to direct Bruckheimer's Armageddon, which I think was the biggest hit of 1998.
It was, yeah. Yeah, there was a pretty big deal made about Armageddon.
Close to $600 million worldwide.
Mm.
2001, he moved on to direct Pearl Harbor, which wasn't as well received as his previous films, but still a pretty big success in the theater. However, after the... I think he took a pretty big critical lashing with Pearl Harbor.
He did, for sure.
In 2003, he reteamed Will Smith and Martin Lawrence again to lick his wounds because, you know, as Sam Raimi puts it, what do you follow up a failure with? The sequel to your success. And this was Bad Boys 2, which was Bay's fifth collaboration with Jerry Bruckheimer. The film grossed $138 million domestically, $273 million worldwide, which was almost twice as much as the first film, but not nearly as much as Bay's biggest success to that point. In 2005, Bay left Jerry Bruckheimer Productions and began a partnership with Steven Spielberg, directing The Island, starring Ewan McGregor and Scarlett Johansson. I'm sure everyone remembers The Island for the little bit of hullabaloo that got kicked up, people saying, you know, it was shamelessly ripping off a little scene 1970 science fiction. What was that movie even called?
Clonus. Is that the one or Logan's Run?
Kronos, the Clone Saga or something like that? Yeah.
The Clonus?
Clonus.
Yeah, I think it's Clonus.
A movie I'd never even heard of before.
It's an MST3K thing. So.
Really?
Yeah, I think so.
So desperate for reasons to hate Michael Bay that it will.
Yeah, well, you know. Yeah. James Cameron ripped off a crappy Harlan Ellison short story for Terminator, so.
And Fern Gully for Avatar.
Hey now, hey. Hey.
Listen, Gabe, who was the only director who was the only director who could dethrone James Cameron was the having the biggest blockbuster in film history? James Cameron.
Anyway, moving right along.
And Bay was chosen as the unlikely director of the film adaptation of the 1980s cartoon Transformers. The film was released in U.S. and Canada in the summer of 2007 and went on to make untold millions in the theater. Bay's return as the director for the following two Transformers movies, which were pretty much crowd-pleasers in theater, but again, severely divided the fan base and the and film critics.
I don't think it really divided film critics.
No.
United film critics on the side of evil. And in June of 2011, Bay confirmed his next movie, Pain and Gain, which I think they actually have a trailer for now.
It was awesome.
Yeah.
It was really good, actually.
It's returning a little bit to his roots and would have a budget of $20 million. And with that horrible introduction, I'm going to apologize, everyone. I've got a sick child in the house, and you're going to get a chance to actually prepare something.
Oh, where is you?
Shut up. It's what you know.
You had a week to prepare.
I was drinking all this week.
You're doing good, John.
Yeah, I mean, I had to, you know, we're talking about Michael Bay here. I had to drink all week.
Had to get in the right mindset.
Then cocaine should be the solution.
Yeah, I'm on coke right now.
When I was about 15 or 16 years old, there was a very short period of my life, actually, legitimately, Michael Bay was my favorite director.
I will say that when I saw The Rock for the first time, I was pretty excited about him. You know, I was like, man, who is this guy? You know? But,
yeah, same here. I remember in high school, I was really into a few of his movies. How many times I watched Bad Boys and The Rock, and there was a period there where I really enjoyed him.
And with that, I think we're going to move on to the bad and the ugly for director Michael Bay. Anyone want to explain the rules about the Gaboos before we go on?
Sorry?
Does anybody want to explain the rules about the good, the bad, and the ugly?
Oh, yeah. First of all, just to remind you that this week we have us.
I didn't even
do the introductions, John Mercer.
I was so excited to jump into the Bayos that I just totally forgot. We'll let Gabe do it in his charming Quebecois accent.
So back with us after that horrible storm, we have John Mercer.
Woo!
Steve Power, who is not saying anything right now.
What? Sorry? What?
He introduced you and you didn't say shit just got real.
And returning to...
You don't pay in 72 hours, I launch the gas.
After a long absence, since we needed an American touch, we have Matt Avrak.
How's it going? I'm back.
Maverick.
Yep.
It's a pleasure.
And me, Gabriel Gerard. So let's go for Good, Bad, and Uglies. The good is what we think is either the best film by Michael Bay or our favorite. The bad is a movie that we like but shouldn't, or that we think has too many flaws to be a good. And the ugly is the one that we hate the most.
Yay! Hate! Who wants to go first?
Spin the wheel. Go, Matt.
All right. Starting when I was invited back to this podcast, I pretty much figured that I was going to pick Armageddon as my good. But then I saw for the first time The Island. Woo-hoo! And I've got to go with that one.
Nice.
So for the first time last week, it was one of his two movies that I initially missed. And had a lot of fun with it. I really did enjoy it. I'll probably be buying a copy for myself. It's actually pretty decent sci-fi. It goes into some, you know, it asks some good questions about, you know, the ethics of, I guess we can spoil this for, I'm not spoil it for a half hour in. It's kind of impossible to talk about it.
It's Matt?
Yeah.
We spoil movies all the time.
Okay. I don't want to get yelled at.
Yeah, if people are listening to this podcast, They know the risks.
Well, I'm spoiling a half hour into it. But as far as the ethics of cloning, it goes, it starts asking some questions of, pretty much going into are the clones real people? Do they deserve the same amount of rights as anyone else? And it gets pretty interesting. And it's got a great cast. It's got, you know, Scarlett Johansson and Hugh Gregor leading the cast. Some supporting acts by, you know, Sean Bean. How do you pronounce his name? Jimon Hounsou. Tim, it is a lot of fun. Steve Buscemi is amazing in it. He's hilarious every moment he's on screen. Michael Clark Duncan is in it for all of two or three scenes, and the giant, huge man that he is goes out screaming like a little bitch, and it's awesome. He's great.
That scene is fantastic, actually.
And it just builds up the danger that they're in. But I really did have a blast with that one.
Anyone who doubts, I'm going to spoil something else now. Anyone who doubts Sean Bean's capability of playing just bone-chillingly evil, The Island is Exhibit A. Just utterly superb villain he made in that movie.
And at the same time, the fact that he exhibits so much pathos when he's in his doctor mood.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you know, he's got these two faces that he plays perfectly. The Island was also my choice for good. I think it's got a very distinctive look for Bay. The colors are not as hyped up. It's more white and stuff, reminiscent of THX, the Lucas movie.
THX 1138.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's more... It is more of a bit focused on characters and on interesting questions and not so much about the action, although there's a lot of action, and it's great action, too. But yeah, it's a fun movie, and it's just not as dumb as the rest of his stuff.
Yeah, by comparison, it's the clear winner.
I wanted to pick The Island, actually. I really did. But I knew, I figured Forbes would be on here, and that would be the one that Forbes would go for. So I said, well, I'll leave it for him.
And Mr. Forbes actually did ask that we do state that The Island was his choice for the good.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah.
I'm a huge fan of it. I love the movie. And, I mean, I'm a big fan of that. I call it that retro sci-fi feel anyway. Anything that came, you know, pre-Star Wars, pre-space fantasy science fiction. You know, all of it, like THX 1138, Logan's Run, Andromeda Strain, you know, Blade Runner, all of that kind of stuff, like that real dystopic sci-fi stuff. I love it. I mean, that's my bread and butter. It's my favorite little subgenre of filmmaking, I think. And The Island, like when I saw the first trailers, I got really hyped because it looked like this classic, you know, return to classic science fiction. And then I saw it directed by Michael Bay, and it's just kind of like, shut up, what? And saw it in theater. I think there might have been five or six people sitting down in the theater when we saw it. wasn't a big crowd. And I walked out, you know, I expected a Michael Bay movie, and I did get a Michael Bay movie, but it was definitely one of his more ambitious features. Like it was you know, rather than putting the ambition into the technical merits, he really did kind of try to make just a cool classic science fiction flick with that distinctly Michael Bay flavor to it, you know, and it was a good flick. It was a really enjoyable flick. It was, you know, McGregor's always fantastic. You know, you got a reliable leading man like McGregor. He can pretty much carry anything. But Bay did a great job with that first half, with that, you know, all the stuff on the island and the lotto and whatnot. But then when the action did hit, man, it was great action.
Yeah, and it did have a lot of a Logan's Run feel.
Yeah, yeah.
It really reminded me of that movie.
The Escape from Dystopia subgenre.
Yeah.
I liked how they made, you know, the residents there kind of naive.
Yeah.
And it didn't quite make them stupid. It didn't make them to a level of being annoying, but it made them lovable.
Yeah.
Well, very, very, very childlike.
Yeah.
You wanted the root for
innocent. Yeah.
And sorry, Matt, go on.
That's right. It's tough to walk that line without it falling into being irritating, like annoying characters you can't wait to get killed. And they did well.
I mean, even that guy who was Ewan McGregor's best friend, in another movie it'd be like really annoying. Jones, or whatever his name was. He's actually pretty endearing in this. So like when he wins the lottery and you see he's almost crying, like, I won, finally.
Yeah, that was, yeah, that, and that was a nice scene too.
Well, it's not the movie I would choose, of course, to represent Michael Bay. Like if somebody had never seen a Michael Bay flick, I wouldn't go and say like, here you go, this is a Michael Bay movie.
Yeah, and beyond that, like, I think the main reason that I wouldn't pick it as my good is because when the action does hit, like, it is so frenetic, it is so fast-paced that it feels, like, completely atypical of the rest of the movie up to that point. Like, it feels, you know, it's kind of like the car chase in the beginning of The Rock, which I'll get to in a little while. It feels really wedged in there, you know, and it just doesn't fit the tone of the rest of the film.
Yeah, I thought felt like to be smashed together. It's kind of sometimes it was a little bit of the same problem that I felt like Total Recall, like where it's on one hand it's this kind of thoughtful sci-fi movie, but it's smashed in with this action movie
that
it almost doesn't need. Yeah. Like I wish it would go a little more deeply into the sci-fi elements.
But the two parts by themselves, the two halves, are both absolutely superb.
They are. They're both awesome. And by Total Recall, are we talking about Schwarzenegger Recall or Colin Farrell?
Oh, of course.
Okay.
Yeah, I haven't even seen that one yet.
Okay, now the Colin Farrell Recall was awesome. The Schwarzenegger Recall, I'm sorry, but Arnold just can't pull off. Maybe I'm still dreaming. You know, like, Verhoeven, why couldn't you have cast Peter Weller in that movie?
Wasn't it your good when we did Verhoeven?
No, I don't think it was.
No.
one thing that did bug me a little tiny bit about the island is that Jimon Hounsou's character basically plays a bounty hunter, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when Ewan McGregor gets out of the facility, this is the guy they send after him.
Yeah.
And outside of the group of cowboys he's going around with, you know, he comes across at first as this really, you know, icy, just cool, calm, and collected badass. And he doesn't seem like the type of character that would let, you know, car chases escalate to the sheer amount of mind-numbing carnage that gets unleashed in that section of the island.
I think it was kind of more of a he didn't really have a choice in the matter situation.
Yeah.
But that change of art near the end is kind of jarring too.
Yeah.
Like where he's like, "Oh, I draw the line at killing clones, and you're going too far."
You're a no, PMC. You're a mercenary, man.
Yeah, but I mean, he can't out and out play a villain.
I guess not.
Yeah, of course.
I suppose.
Mm-hmm. And dude, when's the last time he played a villain? Stargate.
Uh, And I have to give props to that guy with the most awesome beard I've ever seen. He's also in Bad Boys 2. I don't know his name, but he looks like Kerry King from Slayer.
Is that the big guy?
I just call him. What are the guys called for Medal of Honor, Steve? Because that's what I call that guy.
Tier 1.
Tier 1, yeah. He's actually an ex-cop.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Bay for a little while used to use this nonprofit organization in L.A. where they'd use retired or off-duty SWAT officers.
Oh yeah,
that's what he'd fill his SWAT team with in his movies.
Yeah, yeah, I do remember reading something about that.
Yeah, so this guy with the most terrifying beard in history is probably breaching vertical coffins all the time. That beer can stop bullets.
Who's next?
You. What's your choice for good?
Me? I had a few. I was torn between The Island. I almost, believe it or not, I really almost wanted to go Pearl Harbor, just out of the sheer shock value of it all. But then I thought, no man is that insane. And in the end, I decided it has to be Transformers for me.
Woo!
I just, for me, that first film, when the designs first came out and all of that. Okay, for starters, a little bit of backstory. Yes, I'm a child of the early 80s. I came of age in the mid to late 80s, so I was very familiar with the property. I was never a big Transformers nut. I always preferred G.I. Joe. And we won't talk about the cinematic abomination that came out of that franchise. But
Michael Bay should have directed that.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. But with Transformers, I didn't really – like. I was familiar with the backstory. I was familiar with the toys. I was familiar with the old cartoon and the comics and whatnot. So, fine and dandy. I had a background, but I didn't have any real – I didn't have that nostalgic attachment, and I didn't have that – all these young Transformers fanboys who popped up during the rebirth back in the early 2000s who are more rabid and vehement about defending Transformers than the original fans are, But I just, I had no real attachment to it. I saw the designs and I saw Michael Bay's explanation for the designs and how he said, we tried making Optimus Prime look like Optimus Prime and on film it just looked freaking stupid. And mm-hmm. I thought to myself, his head is in the right place. His head is definitely in the right place. And on top of that, you got a movie about giant robots fighting each other in human-populated cities. Carnage, Michael Bay. Who better than Michael Bay? I think the only other director who would have made me happier as a choice would have been Roland Emmerich. And then when I saw the first trailer and saw, what they were doing with it and stuff, I was like, okay, yeah, all right, I could get on board with this. And then when I went and saw it, we saw it opening night, and I think my wife was even looking forward to it more than I was, because she is a Transformers fan. So we sat down, we started watching it, and I was just like, oh my god, this is a 1980 Steven Spielberg movie. This movie is 110% a 1980s Amblin flick. It should have opened with the Amblin logo. This is like something that would have come out of Robert Zemeckis or Joe Dante or one of these other guys working under Spielberg in the early 80s. It feels like a Spielberg movie. It's got that same, it's got the human anchors. The Transformers are not the anchor of the film. It's the human characters, which I like. It's written in a semi-intelligent fashion. It's not written like a big bang, smash 'em up, explosions, pow, pow movie. It is written more as, a story about Sam and his first car. And this is just what happens to go on because of it. It could have been an episode of Amazing Stories, And that's what I like so much about it. That first film really felt like it had a heart. It really felt like, Spielberg had his fingers in it everywhere. And you can tell that he had a lot of input into what was going on with that movie. He really had, the impetus, the whole idea kind of came from his mindset. And it has that vibe to it.
Like the production meetings when they first started playing the movie ended with Steven laying it like a copy of Gremlins or something in front of him. Michael, watch this.
Yeah. Something.
And that's probably how they got John Voight and John Turturro in it too.
Yeah, yeah, and great little cameo by Bernie Mac as the used car dealership owner. That was hilarious, absolutely
Bobby,
hilarious.
Bobby Bolivia,
yeah,
that's my mammy. I'm gonna bust your head open.
But there was so much in that movie that I I really enjoyed. You know, like the action sequences were great. I mean, there was an action sequence in it that inspired an entire level in Call of Duty. You know, like
the. I don't believe it's the first Transformer. I think the first Transformer that you really see is the police car. Wasn't it Barricade?
I think so.
No, the helicopter. I mean,
the helicopter at the beginning. And that sequence, that's in Darfur or wherever it was, where the helicopter transforms and starts trashing the military base. That was freaking stunning. Yeah. That sequence made me sit there and think, oh my God, could you imagine a BattleTech movie? You know?
But there was a sequence I loved, and I know a lot of people actually found it kind of cheesy, but I couldn't help but think of stuff like Gremlins and things like that. Was on Air Force One when the little Decepticon?
Yeah.
And I was watching, I said, that's where I said, that's, you know, that's a monster from a Joe Dante movie right there.
Yeah,
it really is.
Or like the giant robots trying to hide from the parents.
Yeah, it's like, you know? That scene was hilarious. Absolutely awesome. You know, and there's so much of that stuff. And, I mean, John Turturro's character in that first one, he wasn't overplayed like he was in the second one. You know, he was there just enough to be annoying and obnoxious, but not to take over the film or chew the scenery, you know?
Same as Sam's parents.
Yeah,
right?
And Sam's parents in the first movie weren't stupid. They weren't idiots. You know, like
I liked them in the first movie. They were a lot of fun. I'll be honest; they get a lot of flack. They made me laugh in that first movie.
And when his mom,
I don't like people walking on my grass. That's why I made my path.
And when his mom is in the bedroom, you know, like you're all sweaty. What are you doing in here?
Are you masturbating?
mom!
And
you guys call it Sam's happy time.
I catch a lot of flack for this because I know he's kind of a bit of a whipping boy now, but I don't really get it because, I mean, Shia LaBeouf has proven to be a half-decent actor in some of the movies he's been in. You know, Lawless, he was absolutely...
Lawless was a fantastic movie.
That first one he did with DJ Caruso, Disturbia.
Yeah, that was good, yeah.
That was good, and he legitimately felt like a teenager.
Yeah.
It was one of the best things in Wall Street 2.
Yeah, well... Hey, but like, in Transformers, he fit that role perfectly.
Yeah,
he was good. He was the Transformers equivalent to Elliot, or you know, name an '80s Steven Spielberg movie with a central team.
Well, dude, he was like dude from the last Starfighter.
Yeah, you know, like he fit that role perfectly.
Yeah, the audience surrogate without being too bland, like a lot of them are. He was good in that.
Exactly.
I will still admit, and this probably comes from me being a boy in the '80s. The first time Optimus Prime speaks in that movie, it was like a shot of electricity.
Oh, it's awesome. And that Steve Jablonski score is awesome.
Yeah. And then the first, when Prime and Megatron finally go at it at the end of the movie, and you just get that Megatron Prime.
Like, I think... I don't know if this Hasbro just indoctrinated me as a young kid. I used to play with Transformers too, but there's this whole sense of wonder in that movie.
Yeah.
That just telling me the kid grew up playing with Transformers toys, telling me that Optimus Prime is coming, and knowing that he's coming, and the way it builds up to that, it sort of falls apart later. We'll get to that, but just the build up that they're coming.
Yeah,
works for me so well in that movie.
And that sequence too, like the arrival sequence, you get that score swelling right up for the first time.
That's my favorite part of the score, actually.
Yeah, that sequence is just freaking awesome. And Bay directs the shit out of that movie, man.
And I'm sure they got flack for it, but that scene where they all introduce each other, that was so 80s. Like, I'm jazzed.
This looks like a good place to kick it. It was just, it was a fun, you know, like, I make no apologies about it, and I guess, you know, in this era, everybody's a little more cynical, and everybody's a little more conditioned and stuff like that. They can't enjoy something, so just so, I guess, like, whimsical, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
The way I look at it, and especially after the second two movies, if you're looking at a film adaptation of Transformers, you can't ask for anything really more.
No, and you can't...
In the same way, it's like the Matrix catching flack because of the other two flicks too.
Yeah, and I mean, we know the Matrix the sequels do suck, you know, but but Transformers, it was just, I don't know, it was, you know, it was a movie that by all accounts could have been a steaming pile of shit, but there's nothing in there that warrants any degree of hatred whatsoever. You know, it's just like Armageddon. it's a great popcorn movie, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, My Good was a bit of a difficult choice for me too. Up until the third Transformers movie, I had never missed a Michael Bay film in theater. So I've I kind of had an attachment to him, and when I was a teenager, you know, like I said, there was a point where I would have called him my favorite director, and you know, whenever you heard critics say something, it's shot like a music video, what they're really saying is that it looks like it was directed by Michael Bay. You know, the guy created entire visual style, and that whole towards the end of the 90s, early 2000, Bruckheimer golden age of action movies,
yeah.
Right? When every summer you begin the new Jerry Bruckheimer production, they all look like Michael Bay movies for a reason. You know, the guy had has his own definite film style. And I was kicking back a couple different movies trying to pick what my good is. And I mean, they've all got their flaws. They do. But, and it came up to a real hard choice between what is my good and what is my bad. And my bad is my bad for a reason, because I thought it should have been so much more. And it's one of my absolute favorite types of movie, and that makes the flaws a little bit worse. Sat down last night and watched Armageddon for the first time in years. Mm. I never saw Armageddon on DVD, because, I mean, you had the really, really hard-to-get Criterion Edition, then you had this absolute shite Touchstone release.
Non-anamorphic, shitty DVD, yeah.
That horrible widescreen banner on the cover that ruins artwork.
Yeah.
And I picked up the Blu-ray, sat down and watched it, and I was expecting, you know, to be like, oh man, through it. And I got to say, I had a hell of a lot of fun with Armageddon. And that's going to be my choice for good.
Nice.
You know, Bay was, you could tell he had more money. He was moving up a bit more in the world. He had, his leading man now wasn't, he wasn't used as a stand comedian, or it wasn't the gimmick of, the guy who's going to kick ass in this movie is, you know, Sean Connery, and he's old. You know, he had Bruce Willis back when Bruce Willis was still, you know, a box office draw. Back when his name on a poster could bring people into the theater.
It was the Bruce Willis of, like, Unbreakable and Sixth Sense era Bruce Willis, too, wasn't it?
Just prior to that, he was, Bruce still had some energy to him.
Yeah.
He wasn't super sleepy.
No, it's just that I remember he was kind of, like, he was in a career renaissance again then.
From Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
Maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm a sucker for the whole Motley Crue saving the world. And, you know, the heroes, you don't get heroes much more ragtag than a bunch of oil drillers from Armageddon. And it's just a colorful cast. As stupid as the science is in the movie, you know, people, it's another one of those ones that's really fun to go back and bash the hell out of now. I remember telling I don't even know what the guy's name was. Steve, you used to work at Microplay back in the day, back just when you were first starting up there.
Not Rob.
Dude was bit of a sinusoid, heavier set guy.
That was probably Rob. That was probably Rob King.
And I remember him getting into me because he was talking about Dark City at the time. And Dark City's a fantastic sci-fi movie. And I made a comment that I found Armageddon was written smartly. And I didn't mean the science. I didn't mean the science. What I meant is that it just had the dialogue was really, really snappy.
It was a witty flick, yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, when I went back and watched it last night, I didn't know J.J. Abrams was.
J.J. Abrams and Jonathan Hensley, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I was watching, I was like, oh, that's why it works. And yeah, Buscemi is, again, like in The Island, just fucking hilarious whenever he's on camera.
There was something about Buscemi in those Bruckheimer flicks, because he's amazing in Con Air, too.
Yes.
I think it's just, you know, like, the guy knows he's Weasel and he's kind of embracing that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like, I was always a sucker for Owen Wilson's got this great line about stuff. What is it? This is true deep blue hero stuff.
Yeah.
That just kind of sets the table for the whole movie for me.
I still love Buscemi's little exchange about the Roadrunner. No, yeah, I've seen this one. This is the one where the coyote straps himself to a giant Acme rocket.
Straps himself to a pair of roller skates and sits his ass down in a slingshot with an Acme rocket. From the coyote.
Like, the movie's got a really good ensemble to it. Like, it's got a really good group of people. You feel like, you know, they're not really deep characters, but you feel like you know them all. You feel like they're friends. And I think Bay's movies that work have good characters, and without the characters, the movie turns into fluff. But Armageddon has that really well.
It does. It definitely does. And Willis kind of takes a step back, too, which I like. Mm-hmm. You know, Willis kind of lets...
He dials back a lot. He dials back the action hero stuff. I did find his accent was really weird because he sounds like he's chewing on the insides of his cheek all the time.
Well, what he does with it is he kind of slips in and out of that Texan accent, and whenever he does the Texan accent, he's absolutely terrible.
Yeah. But then he says, where's Willis? Is he from New York, I think?
I don't even remember.
I forget. No, he's got this kind of cadence when he talks.
Yeah.
Like, Willis has got a definite accent. But yeah, he's sitting there doing the Texan accent, and then you got Owen Wilson standing next to him who, you know,
is Texan.
And it sounds terrible.
Yeah. And he does drop it about, I think about a half hour, 45 minutes into the movie, it does kind of disappear.
Yeah. And you got Will Patton, who was fantastic. Mm-hmm. You know, we see enough of him. I believe he's a Southerner, too. And it sounds really, really awkward.
One thing you have to add to Armageddon 2 is that Bay was totally knew what kind of movie it was making and just decided to run up with it. It's basically a glorified B-movie.
Dude, I picture, you know, he starts filming, he's on his director's chair, puts down his sunglasses and says, lights, cameras, explosions. And there's, you know, I remember a big joke when Armageddon was first released is, see how long Michael Bay can last before he makes a cut. There's never a camera shot in Armageddon longer than a minute.
I thought it was like the film's average is there's a cut every 1.8 seconds or something like that.
Yeah, it's something like that. Yeah.
That must have been hell to edit, man.
it flows really well. It's very, very, very high energy. And I kind of looked at there was, you know, you had Keith David's whole hard-ass military guy. They didn't feel the need to stick in a stupid asteroid before them. You know, they get up in space. The bad guy's the asteroid, right?
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. You don't have this. You don't have, you know, you don't have the Dr. Smith character who's there to see them fail.
Yeah.
Isn't there one of them who goes crazy, though? I haven't seen it in years.
Steve Buscemi gets a little bit of space dementia.
Yeah.
Space dementia, yes.
I love the space dementia.
This is a surrealistic nightmare.
Like, they have William Fichtner almost become not quite a villain, but they have William Fichtner doing what he thinks is right and trying to kill them on orders at one point, but he does it out of being good.
I love Will Patton's line in that scene. What the hell are you doing with a gun in space? Will Patton has the best lines in that movie.
Well, just for the fact that, you know, he's, like Gabe said, you know, Bay knew he was making a B movie. Will Patton didn't.
Yeah. But I mean, I love that, you know, Fichtner is doing what he thinks is right, what he, you know, and like his turn too, like when the guys kind of power him.
It's not just following orders either.
Yeah.
He's not doing it to follow orders. He legitimately feels they failed.
Yeah.
This is the only option.
But what is he says, you know, I've got a daughter down there too, or something like that, right? And, you know, and.
Swear on your daughter's life, on my fans, you can hit that mark.
Yeah.
Yep. And that line at the end of the movie when they land and he says, permission to shake the hand of the daughter of the bravest man I've ever met.
Yeah.
It's like a great line.
Yeah.
Great line.
I tear it up. I tear it up at the part.
Mm-hmm. That movie, I remember I saw it twice in theater opening weekend because.
Oh, you were there for the infamous. The power outage?
Yeah, 18 minutes left of the movie and the power went out. And, of course, everybody over there wanted to go see how it ended, so we went again. And when we got to the ending, man, it was like Return of the King. You know, half the audience was just like sniffle, 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 sniffle. You know. And then we look over at our buddy Chuck, who was there with us, and he was bawling. It was just like, oh. And then we walked out, and we sat in the car. I was driving home, and Chuck was sitting in the back seat, like, "That was the greatest movie I've ever seen."
I saw it opening. I saw it opening night. I was in another theater, though.
Oh, okay.
So we didn't have the power outage.
Yeah, we saw it in,
and
so
sorry.
We saw it in Mount Pearl. That was where the power outage was.
And then I went and saw it the next day again. And yeah, it was just one of, it's Armageddon's one of those movies. It's the DC kept thing. You get to the end credits and you want to watch it again.
Yeah, it leaves you feeling pretty good.
Yeah,
it's not quite the feel good movie that Twister is, but you know it leaves you feeling.
But now, oh my God! Imagine if Bill Paxton was in Armageddon.
Oh my God! No, no, realities are starting to implode now.
With space dementia, he could do that.
With space dementia.
Yeah.
Game over, man. Game over.
So yeah, that was my choice for good. And outside of the cheesy Aerosmith song, there's it's aged pretty well.
It's hilarious that Steven Tyler even hates that song. Hey.
No, it's aged pretty well. I still found the effects actually look pretty good. Even the I thought the explosion at the end of when they split the asteroid half looked cheesy as hell.
It did, yeah.
Yeah. It all still works out pretty well. I really enjoyed it.
That was the hourglass explosion, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, that was pretty lame.
Mm. Yeah, but at least, I mean, it doesn't look like late 90s CG, though.
No, it doesn't. It just looks like a stylistic choice.
Yeah, it still looks like $200 million CG.
Yeah.
You know, I started the movie, and my wife came in and said, "Why are you watching this?"
Because it has happened before, and it will happen again.
Oh, Heston.
Yes, there you go. Chuck Heston narration at the beginning of it. This shit just got real. And with that, I think that's a good segue to get into the bad.
I'll leave one last thought on Armageddon. Armageddon is the most gross example of the one thing about Michael Bay's style that really kind of drives me insane. The rotate around the room cam.
Mm-hmm.
Like during exposition scenes, like one character will be there giving exposition and the camera just continuously spins around the room in a circle. Yeah. And it's just like, oh my God, stop! Just stop! There is no need for the camera to be moving right now.
We'll get to our worst example soon.
It's about like 10 or 15 shots of the people exiting the hangar with the heat haze.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't mind the wet pavement shots. That's cool. I'm down with that. I can get behind that. I hate that spin around the room cam. I really hate it.
But it really, to me, speaks of this was his first time with a huge, huge budget.
It was his first film as like an A-list director, right?
And you can tell, like, it's 2.5 hours long, and Michael Bay probably had about 90 minutes worth of shots.
Yeah.
So he just, you know, he just starts throwing everything in his repertoire to get it to work.
And the other thing is the extremely horrible line of dialogue and delivery from Bruce Willis that is just extremely terrible exposition that doesn't need to be in the movie at all. And every time I see it, I groan and want to punch myself in the face. We've been dragged, blah, 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 yada, yada, yada. Now, why don't you tell us what we're doing here in such and such in Houston?
At the Johnson Space Center.
Yeah, oh, my God, that line. Oh, that's even worse than, "You shall be the Fellowship of the Ring." It really makes me want to, like, punch Bruce Willis very hard.
You know what else Armageddon had?
What's that?
A lack of Mark Mancina.
It did. It did have a lack of Mark Mancina. I don't know. Who did the score for Armageddon?
I think it's Trevor Rabin.
Oh, okay.
Which isn't a whole lot better, but
it's still better. Less.
And with that, let's get on to our bed. Who wants to go first here?
Who went first last time?
Matt.
That's me. I can go for it.
Matt, go first.
All right, my bad. It's going to be Transformers first.
Get
one.
Out.
Yeah, we kind of covered what I liked about it, and you know the build up and everything. But eventually it didn't really build into anything. Like, they got a lot of momentum going, and then just kind of nothing really happened. Had some problems with the characters. We got Optimus Prime, we got Bumblebee. The villain isn't introduced till about an hour and 40 minutes into the movie. And outside of them, there really aren't any other characters. Again, this is a movie about fighting robots, but I still felt like I didn't know any of the other Autobots or the other Decepticons. There are some names. And I hear Starscream, and my childhood goes, "Oh my God, Starscream!" But nothing. You know, nothing ever comes of it.
Yeah,
there isn't any impact from all that.
The Decepticons are really treated as aliens, aren't they? You don't see very much of them.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And even the Transformers, they're kind of are, that, besides Optimus Prime and Bumblebee, to tell apart.
I didn't really have a problem with it because, like I said earlier, I did really like that human center. I did really like that it centered on the humans. And like on the military guys and Sam, you know, kind of back and forth between them. But then now you get into your issue, Matt. Like, name two of the army guys.
Yeah.
Name their characters. Tell me what their characters' names were.
The guy is not Timothy Oliphant, the other guy.
And left cheek.
Like the movie does play like – it really doesn't play like a Transformers movie. It really plays like a disaster movie where the humans are – the disaster is that these two warring giant robot races are destroying the planet. That's pretty much what the kind of a disaster movie it is.
Whoever wins, we lose.
Yeah.
Basically, yeah. And then we start going into –
Transformers? Their War, Our World.
Their War, Our World, yeah.
Yeah.
And we start getting into a lot of kind of the stereotypes. One of the most painful things about a Michael Bay movie is when he tries to do comic relief, and a gay character will pop up, or here there's a lot of stereotypes. The movie opens up with a Latino guy speaking Spanish, and the comic relief is, speak English, you know?
English, dude.
It gets to be a little offensive, and it goes through all of his movies.
Talking about eating alligators and crickets for 6 months, I'm never going to your mama's house.
I think that the worst offender in the first Transformers flick is whatever his name is, taking off his gas cap and just lubricating the guy with it.
Lubricate the human.
Stop lubricating the humans. Now,
I wonder what was going through his head when he read that line too.
I can definitely understand where you're coming from, and yeah, he doesn't really do a lot of build up for the characters, but I mean, I think just that type of movie, and I guess the difference there too is I don't have the attachment to the characters that you have either. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I hear Starscream and I remember Starscream and all of that, but it doesn't mean anything to me, you know.
Yeah, I mean, by the time I don't know if, how much really into the sequels, but by the time you get to the third movie, two particular characters die. One Transformer who has been in all three movies dies, an Autobot, and then a Decepticon also dies who's been in all three movies.
But it doesn't mean.
And if you didn't happen to know who they are, you'd have to point out who they are. Like, did you realize that it's Ironhide? He's been in all three movies. No. You should feel something, but they fail to be characters at all.
Yeah.
And just the fact that they had these CGI creatures, they forget to turn them into characters. And again, I realize what I'm asking of a Transformers movie, but I guess child me wants, as an adult, still wants to see those as characters and have it mean something. Mm. And it's a missed opportunity.
And I think too that like that's a big sign there of what's wrong with the sequels. I mean, they kind of forgo the human element and get more into just your robots bashing on each other, and it has no soul whatsoever. It's completely soulless. You know, yeah. And then you get when they do bring the humans into it, they're just horrible comic relief. Like, you got Sam's parents running around the university, and then you got John Turturro's character as this checked up conspiracy theory nut who's, you know, I'm aiming at his testicles. Like, it's so ridiculous when the humans come into it, and then that anchor, that Spielberg feel that was in the first movie is completely absent in the sequels.
Yep.
You know, it's just not there. The sequels are empty, vapid experiences, you know?
There is no tiger shirt. We looked.
And even in the first one, there's like extraneous stuff, like the girl copying the stuff on the chip and then going to see her friend, and they get captured there and bring back the bunker. You don't need that. All of that. That's useless.
Yeah. In all honesty, I'd completely forgotten that subplot even existed. Thanks, Gabe.
Yeah. And all of Bay's movies, they're all too long. They're all
they're 2 hours and 30.
Yeah, about 2 hours, 3 minutes. Like everyone, and they all have stuff just like that. You can just cut off to make them better.
Yeah.
And like you know, these are most of these are kind of dumb movies. And when I watch a dumb movie, I'm not really in the mood for a 2.5 hour epic, much less three of them in a row, like a trilogy.
Yeah.
You know, you make a dumb movie, make it 88 minutes, make it some kind of a make it a short movie. So it'll be good. But if, you know, if I want a 2.5 hour movie, I'm going to watch something a little more epic. I'll watch like a Master and Commander or something, you know, that's got some meat to it. I'm not going to watch 2.5 hours of mindless, you know, nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think another thing with those sequels is it really proves that the Transformers fans didn't know what the hell they wanted. You know, like, and you think about it. You think about the premise, and you think about all the mythology and stuff behind Transformers and what could actually work as a live-action film. Mm-hmm. I think as far as the fans are concerned, he would have been better off never doing it. You know, like, it would have been better off if those movies had never happened. Because the fans, you know, they complain about the first one that it was too much human stuff, not enough to robots, and blah, 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 blah. And then the second one and the third one, he amps up the robot violence and makes them more the focal point. And what happens? The fans all bitch and moan because it's a mindless explosion fest. It's like, I'm sorry, guys, this is what you asked for, you know?
Like, each one kind of reveals different parts of Bay's problems. Like, the first one gets some things right, then it fixes that, quote, fixes that, and all of a sudden we've got, you know, these stupid twins, and someone will probably get on that later. And then the third movie, it's like, okay, the twins and the humor are gone, it's now much slower pace, and the slower pace of the third movie shows that he can't do slow, and it just ends up being kind of dull.
Yeah.
And it is, they show different problems as he compensates for different things by – he fixes things by creating more problems each time.
I hear you. And, yeah, I can definitely see that. I can definitely see where you're coming from.
Yeah.
I'd be inclined to agree with that. Who goes next?
Okay. I can't believe I'm going to say what I'm going to say. But if you want to talk about overindulgence and ridiculousity and how awesome something so ridiculous can be, I have to go with Bad Boys 2 as my bad. Yes, I did enjoy this pile of crap. because it is so over the top that at most points I was like, is he making a parody? Like, I was laughing my head off. Because it's so over the top that it's unbelievable. I mean, so many dumb, ridiculous, over the top moment in this movie. It's nonstop. I mean, you have this chase scene on the highway where they're pushing a morgue truck and the doors open and there's body flying on the highway. there's a scene where Martin Lawrence takes ecstasy
and it's so. Dan Marino should definitely buy this car. Well, not this one because I'm gonna fuck this one up.
Okay, what else? There is the infamous Pinocam in the scene where they fight the Jamaicans.
In the apartment. It was actually kind of cool there, though.
Yeah.
It is really cool, but it is overdone like the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
Do the Bad Boys shot two or three times in the movie where the two of them stand up and the camera rotates around them.
Oh, right? The classic spino cam. The shit just got real cam.
Yes.
and I mean, it's not enough to have one baddie play Tapia. You also have to have Peter Stormare as a crazy Russian in there too. and rats. And Will Smith's boinking Martin Lawrence's sister, who's actually an undercover cop. I mean, this you can't make this stuff up.
I will say this much for it. It is light years better than the first one.
And another one, it's another one where it's too long. Like, this one's, 2.5 hours, this one?
You think that the movie is over. You think, you know, that the third act is hit and everything's been resolved and everything is winding down, and let's get on a Black Hawk and go to Cuba. What the hell?
There's a scene where they start to raid the bad guy's compound. You're like, okay, this is the end of the movie. Like, no, we just killed the one guy, and then there's this whole other half hour in Cuba.
But then that gave Michael Bay a chance to totally steal a scene from Jackie Chan's Police Story.
Oh, okay.
I forgot about that. We're going down over the favela.
Yeah, they destroy a whole shanty town.
Yes, with the Humvee.
My first thought was like, those poor Cuban people. And then I'm like, wait, this is straight out of the Jackie Chan movie.
My first thought was, wow, Havana sure looks a lot like Rio de Janeiro. Has Michael Bay ever been to Havana?
But it's like, to me, it's like, it's so over the top and so parody that it basically parodies itself.
Like, it would have been a great ending to that movie. And they're, and I can't really say much, because as much as I hate Bad Boys 2, the villain death is
amazing.
Just absolute fucking classic.
Amazing.
But what would have made that scene even better is when they were standing outside the military base and the guy gets on the bullhorn and starts shouting at him and they ignore him. If some guy just opened fire with a 50 caliber.
And killed them both.
Just blew the shit out of all three of them.
And I forgot to mention that
Cuba. Yes, you were, as a corpse.
I forgot to talk about first the scene at the beginning where the drug traffickers are actually the KKK, and then Will Smith grazes Martin Lawrence's ass with his bullet, and then they talk about that later while they're being filmed, and everybody who sees them thinks they're gay.
Because it's hilarious.
Because it's hilarious.
Yeah, the comic relief with you know, you have to think the gay people are funny. That's, you know, it is, you can do about it.
But at the same time, like me, I was watching it, I guess, from some kind of distance. I'm like, is this movie just making fun of these concepts and like that these guys are basically gay for each other? Like in all of those buddy cops movies like Point Break and stuff.
Yeah, the bromance. Yeah, I could see that, yeah.
I was like, Michael Bay is not smart enough to do this, but I was seeing, I was basically seeing the movie making fun of itself and like the snake eating its own tail.
I was like pretty on board with Bad Boys, except for any scene where Martin Lawrence took the lead. Well, Bad Boys 2. Yeah. And from what I understand, there was a lot of one-upmanship going on in Bad Boys 2. Like, apparently, if Will Smith had a trailer, Martin Lawrence had to have a bigger trailer, and he had to have his own private basketball court, and then he needed, like, two scenes or three scenes in the movie where he got to improv, and, you know.
Lawrence got so pudgy about that movie, he shouldn't be in the police anymore.
Yeah. Apparently, it's just where Will Smith had such a crazy career after the original Bad Boys, and Lawrence never really went anywhere but shit movies. You know, apparently.
Black Knight.
Yeah.
Yeah, say what you will about Bay. I mean, but when Bad Boys 1 came out, he was the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Who would have ever thought he would be, like, the biggest box office draw?
Yeah.
You know, every one of his movies is, like, this huge super blockbuster for, like, an action movie. I would never have thought to cast him.
Yeah, and I mean, and he was still in total Fresh Prince mode when Bad Boys came out, you know?
Yep.
But, yeah, I totally now understand that line in Odd Fuzz where Nick Frost's like, you ain't seen Bad Boys 2? So that's my confession for today. I enjoyed Bad Boys 2. Who's next?
Steve, what's your bad?
My bad. I had a few that I kept rolling around in my mind. One of them, which I think would have really been my first choice, but I'll leave it for you. And I'm going to take...
We're going to have a good discussion about this one.
Yeah, we will. So in lieu of that, I'm going to take Pearl Harbor as my bad. Because in spite of all the shit that Pearl Harbor got in the aftermath, and I just like to say, fuck you, Trey Parker and Matt Stone. Because you guys are such fucking cinematic geniuses, you know. But... I think Pearl Harbor really gets a bad rep. You know, I don't think the movie deserves the shit that it gets. And, I mean, it does catch a lot of flack. I don't consider it really an excessive film. A lot of people think, you know, it's the prime example of Hollywood hubris and all of this. You know, it's built into something that it just isn't. You know, it's not some big, huge star vehicle. It was Ben Affleck and Josh Hartnett, for God's sake. You know? And it wasn't Ben at the height of his prime or anything like this. You know, it was just... two guys.
And Beckinsale wasn't quite that known.
Yeah, nobody knew who the hell Kate Beckinsale was when it came out. You know, it wasn't some big star pitcher or anything like this. It was Michael Bay basically trying to make his equivalent of Saving Private Ryan, and the Disney executives basically telling them, no, we want Titanic. You know? That's what Pearl Harbor was. Pearl Harbor was Michael Bay trying to make one kind of movie and Jerry Bruckheimer working against him the entire time.
And actually, this is where the cracks in the armor with the Bay-Bruckheimer friendship really started to show.
Yeah.
And I'll give this to Pearl Harbor. He really did try to recapture that old Hollywood flick
exactly,
feel.
Exactly. I mean, and that's the thing. It's like Baz Luhrmann's Australia. You know, Australia is a movie I absolutely love. I unequivocally love that movie. And it feels like an old-time movie. It doesn't feel like a product of the 20th or 21st century. You know, it feels classic. And Pearl Harbor does have that same kind of golly gee whiz, you know, that old war propagandist kind of feel. You know, it does feel like a film that came out in the 1940s or early 1950s. It doesn't feel like a 21st century production, even though the effects are state-of-the-art and, you know, Bay's direction is hyperkinetic, you know, but it's a solid little movie. It's a well-put-together movie. But the reason it is my bad is because of those parts that are shoehorned in that just, you know, didn't really have to be there.
Yeah, watching them all in a row, watching all of Bay's movies in a row this week, that really is the odd man out.
Yeah, it feels different. It does feel different. And the director's cut is a vast improvement because they do dial back. Like, you know, the romance isn't as, aw, shucks, golly gee whiz, as it is in the theatrical cut. You know, like, it does feel a little bit more natural. It doesn't feel as forced. And, I mean, the attack sequence in the director's cut is absolutely astounding. You know, they really don't pull any punches in that scene. And it's not, you know, outside of one glaring, blatant, you know, head full of hamburger rolling past the camera, it's not played for shock value. Like, it even kind of... I dare I say it's even a little bit less shock value played than Saving Private Ryan's opening sequence. I mean, it's nowhere near as competent as Ryan's opening sequence, but it does play things down a little bit more than Ryan does. You know, you don't have scenes like the soldier walking around looking for his arm and stuff like this, you know? It's not that blatant. But it is, you know, like, as far as Bay goes, I mean, it's definitely one of the finest sequences that man has ever conceived. That, like, that Pearl Harbor attack sequence is just, that must have been a logistical nightmare, man, to pull off, you know?
And it is gorgeous, too.
And it is.
The camera follows the heavy bomb right from the bottom of the zero down through the
Arizona.
It's right down through the heart of the Arizona.
Yeah, and I mean, that whole sequence, man, is just, it's such a punch of a sequence. And... You know, I did get attached to the characters before that. I did kind of get invested in Affleck and Hartnett before that. So, I mean, I did feel a little bit of an emotional attachment to him when all this was going on. But then, of course, in the end of it, they have to fall back on the whole relationship angle again, you know, that the pregnant Kate Beckinsale and that horrible, horrible exchange between the two of them during the Doolittle raid. You know, it's just like, why? Why did you do this? That whole sequence.
It's kind of sick. I mean, the supporting cast in Pearl Harbor was awesome.
It was excellent.
Alec Baldwin as Doolittle was fantastic.
Fantastic,
John Waits at FDR is fucking legendary.
Incredible. Mm-hmm. Really well done, yep. The whole movie, man, like, it's just, you know, I don't understand. I think the hatred towards it is just that there was hype over it before it came out, and I think a lot of it has to do with, like, the after effect of Armageddon as well. You know, from the director of Armageddon, oh, that hunk of shit. You know, like, a lot of people kind of trashed Armageddon for a lot of the same reasons, too. And it's just, it's not cynical.
After they paid to see it four times.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and a lot of, like, the Matrix bite back and stuff like that, too. You know, it's just, I don't know. I think it's, you know, it's an example of, you know, earnest filmmaking at a time when film goers, like, especially with the advent of the internet and all these, you know, everybody online now all of a sudden is a film critic and they've got a voice and stuff like that, but they're all just so freaking cynical, you know? You got a bunch of guys who were raised on a diet of shitty B-grade horror movies who are reviewing stuff like Pearl Harbor and Armageddon. Of course they're going to fucking hate it. Of course they are, you know? Like...
Well, I still never quite understood, like, after having seen it, the flag that it got at the time, because I've, like, the only thing that came to mind was, like, hey, this is as bad and as good as Titanic was.
Yeah, exactly.
It's nothing better and it's not worse. It's just that same romantic bullshit with the catastrophe scenario, you know? But we'll get more to that later.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know. I still just feel that it's the negative stuff that it gets, like the amount of negativity surrounding that movie is just ridiculous and totally not earned. But that said, I mean, yeah, it does have its problems. It does have pacing issues. The romance subplot does go on a little bit too long. It gets a little bit long in the tooth. And
oh shit! I said earlier it wasn't a big hit. No, Jesus Christ! This thing brought in $500 million.
Pearl Harbor was huge, man. Huge.
I saw it opening weekend, and I think Studio 12 here in St. John's was still fairly new at this point.
Yeah, yeah.
And I can remember going in there, and the entire inside of the theater was all just hanging World War II propaganda posters.
Yeah, it was a big deal made about that movie, man. Yeah. And I think that's a lot of it. I think it's a prime example of hype killing the movie. You know, what everybody was expecting to be the next Titanic or, you know, the next Saving Private Ryan or something like that. You know, everybody had a preconceived notion going in. And I think the people who were expecting the next, like, Saving Private Ryan were disappointed by the romance aspects of it and the old-timey filmmaking, you know, like the old-timey storytelling. And then people who were going expecting the next Titanic found it a little bit too grisly and a little bit too fast-paced, you know? So, I mean, there was no pleasing anybody with that one, right? It was a loss. It was just, and I can't even say it was reach exceeding grasp, because I think Bay had a pretty clear grasp of what he wanted to do with it, and I think it just got fucked by producers. I think between Disney and Bruckheimer, the movie just, it couldn't succeed based on what they wanted versus what Bay wanted. You know, when you want a Titanic, you don't hire Michael Bay to direct it.
Like, it's manufactured. It's like they're, you could see the show business side of,
yeah,
of this one.
Exactly.
You really see it.
Exactly. You could see the lack of heart, you know? Mm. The lack of personal investment.
It's true.
All right, John, what's your bad?
This is a bit of a heart-wrenching thing for me because I love action movies. Surprise, guys. Dark Secret is out. I love action movies. You know, I've got I'm rolling up near 800 movies downstairs, and you know, I've got all sorts of Hong Kong action movies. Pretty much anything that involved the 1980s and bullets is on my shelf. And I remember seeing The Rock in theaters opening night. 14 years old, so I still had to sneak into movies at this point. And, I was still 13. This came up before my birthday. So sneaking in to see it and having my mind absolutely blown by it and then going back to it. And for everything that works in The Rock, there's two things that don't. Mm-hmm. And I sat down to watch it last week and I still love it to pieces. Just, there's so much ham-fistedness on screen and so much you could really see the overindulgence. I mean, no, it's not a 2.5 hour long bloated movie. But I mean, there's a ton of stuff in The Rock that just could have been cut out. I'm going to let Steve talk about the car chase because I know he loves bringing this up.
Yeah.
So you can go ahead and bring up the car chase. We'll move on to other stuff in a minute.
The movie should have cut when you've got the interrogation scene where they've got him brought out of the prison and they send Nicolas Cage in to sit down and chat with him, and Cage promises him this and that and the other thing, and you know, he signs his little thing and then brings it in, and Spencer's character tears it up, and then you see Connery bust the glass with his elbow and pop in, "Womack, I should have known, you piece of shit." It should have cut there and went right to the SEAL underground, like right to when the guys were preparing to go into Alcatraz. If the movie...
Connery with his hip new haircut.
Yeah, in a suit with a hip new haircut ready to go. It should have cut right from that scene with the safe, with the one-way mirror, right to that. The movie would have been very nearly perfect if they had done that. It would have been one of the all-time classic action films, as far as I'm concerned, because everything that comes after that interrogation room scene, right up to when the helicopters leave for Alcatraz, is a steaming pile of utter, total, retarded fucking bullshit. Absolute bullshit. It feels so goddamn out of place in what is otherwise an awesome movie. That whole sequence is garbage. Absolute, like, Bad Boys level retardation. You know, it's just mouth-breathing simpleton fodder is what it is. You know, hey, let's have a Ferrari and a Humvee chase through San Francisco. Oh, my God, it was just, it enrages me.
You want to talk about the forced comedy, too? And
I'm only borrowing your Humvee.
And then you hit the barber.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Stylist?
Again with the stereotypes.
Yeah, yep. Like, it was just... Oh, my God.
FBI agents, and not just normal FBI agents, the detail that are traveling with the fucking director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation
yeah.
being distracted by room service.
It was just... It was
the top cops in the most powerful country in the world.
Hey, look at this spread of room service. It was
distracted by lobster bisque.
Yeah, oh.
And it's not even, it doesn't show how, because, I mean, they keep bringing up in the movie, you know, how clever and how resourceful Mason is. And once he gets on the island, you get to see that firsthand. The guy is just fucking engine of badass, yeah. Right?
It was all unnecessary.
Yeah, that scene in the hotel doesn't, you know, it's not being clever. It's not, it's stupid.
It is ridiculously stupid.
And adding the link with his daughter is totally useless too. Like, it doesn't serve anything.
It serves no purpose whatsoever. Like,
yeah.
It doesn't even humanize the character. You know, it doesn't even add a human element to Connery because.
Well, I think they're trying to give him a reason to stay on the island once the SEAL team gets killed. Why doesn't he just run away? Why does he stay and keep fighting? That's what she's there for. But it's not good.
It doesn't
enough,
work.
Really,
it's not a hook at all. It's a side trip.
You wouldn't even have to cut that aspect out of the movie. You could even just have that in a line, him reveal that he has a daughter, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
Doesn't have to be there. I mean, just for the sake that he even says it in the interrogation scene, you know, I've been in jail long enough, maybe you want me to run for president. Maybe he just sees this as a means of escape. I mean, you even see it at the end of the movie when him and Cage are on the island or whatever. He's like, F this, I'm gone, you know? I'm just going to fade away. Maybe that was his plan all along. Maybe he knew that Womack wasn't going to let him go, so he just planned to escape anyway. You know, like, but you don't even need to make changes. You just, and that's what makes it even worse to me. Like, we can sit down and talk about movie X or movie Y and say, oh, well, if they had changed this and just added this or took this away and added this. But with The Rock, they wouldn't have even had to add anything. Mm. All it would have been was one cut. You know?
And that's stuff that drives me insane. Okay. For all the flaws, and I mean, we do make fun of Sean Connery quite a bit.
We do.
Yeah.
Because he is worthy of ridicule.
Yeah. But in The Rock, Connery brought his A-game.
He did. He was badass as all hell in that movie.
That introduction with the silhouette, the long hair, was awesome.
And when you see him actually, like, starting to unload on the SEALs.
Yep.
You're right, and you, like... Lighting dude on fire in the nonsensical minecart tunnel underneath the island.
Oh, the minecart tunnel.
Why is it there? Because it worked for Steven Spielberg.
Why is there a minecart under Alcatraz? Because fuck you, that's why.
And there's so much there that works, okay? You have got one of my absolute favorite action movie villains. In general, Francis Hummel.
Oh, he is one of the greats. He's up there for me with Simon from Die Hard with a Vengeance. He is one of the great action movie villains, man.
And I've seen the behind-the-scenes footage, and everyone knows that Ed Harris is certifiably insane.
Yep.
But it fucking worked for The Rock.
Yeah.
And I sat down, I watched it, and here we go, spoiler warning. When the two douchebag Marine captains turn on him at the end.
Yep.
You know, the lovably slimy... Todd and the other one who I don't know who the actor is, but he succeeded in making like this guy on Lithgow School of Villainy.
I call him Ugly Bill Pullman.
No, because I thought for a second that William Forsythe had put on his flat top makeup again.
I thought that might have been William Sadler too, but
a little bit, yeah.
Yeah,
like it's a like Hummel's almost an anti-hero.
Yeah.
And he turns because he did everything out of trying to do something right, and
so the best villains always think they're doing the right thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Even if you've got somebody who's reprehensibly evil in their head, they're doing what needs to be done.
I also love
the only artless guy is basically Tony Todd.
Yeah, Tony Todd and Ugly Bill Pullman.
And I was sitting there watching. You got the scene where the two of them turn. And then, David Morse goes out like pure man.
Yeah.
Right? This guy goes out like a soldier. And I was sitting there watching that scene. I was like, and the little argument he has with Ed Harris prior to that, after Harris deactivates the first rocket fucking in midair.
Yeah.
And I sit there going, you know what? If they had just made a movie where the guys took over Alcatraz and then David Morse decided to turn on them because he felt they were going too far, I would have watched that movie too.
Yep.
Right? But those Marines are awesome. Michael Biehn should play every Navy SEAL in every movie.
I read an interview with him somewhere where he actually kind of bitched about always having to be cast to play a Navy SEAL.
It's because he's so awesome at it. The guy, Michael Biehn should just change his name to Dwayne Hicks. Because that's what he
is. Corporal Dwayne Hicks, USMC.
Yeah. Ooh, Navy SEALs.
If you, I love Navy SEALs.
SEALs, fantastic. Arguably the best movie Louis Teague ever directed.
I always thought it was the only movie Louis Teague ever directed.
Cujo, man, Cujo.
And Jewel of the Nile.
And there's no comparison between Navy SEALs and Jewel of the Nile.
No.
No.
Jewel of the Nile is way better. No, it's a thing. I actually really dig Navy SEALs. I really enjoy that movie.
There's a, but the stuff with The Rock, this should have been, not could have been, this should have been the best of the Die Hard sequels, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It should have been not just, you know, a rebirth of the 80s action movie. You know, this is the type of movie you go in there and it's like, it's like you saw this the weekend after Lethal Weapon.
Yeah.
It's like action movies didn't lose a step. Arnold Schwarzenegger didn't get old. You know, it was a movie so phenomenally badass that we all thought Nicolas Cage could do action movies. And there's so much of it that works. Great villain, great action sequences, some of the Marine deaths, and, you know, the guy getting the air conditioner falling on top of him.
Oh.
The dude with the top knot getting thrown off the minecart and he just nails
the rocks.
Rocks is going down. You know, you've got the shower sequence, which is one of the greatest action scenes I've ever seen.
I still remember, man, the first time I saw the movie, how freaking intense I found that scene. I actually had to skip back and watch it again.
Well, and it's one of those things. There was a video game back in 2005 called Black. Has an entire level inspired by that sequence.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's one of those absolutely fantastic action movie moments. There's so much that works.
Modern Warfare 2 had a level that was the same thing, too, actually.
And then there's the fact that they felt it necessary to hire Quentin Tarantino to do a rewrite. And that's the stuff, again, like the car chase, that just kills parts of The Rock for me. When Tony Todd gets his ticket punched at the end and, you know, gets basically hit in the chest with a rocket and pushes him out a window and he gets impaled on the fence. Awesome, awesome villain death. The Elton John line before that?
That was horrible.
Yeah.
Just punching myself in the testicles.
No, I got to say, you know, that the whole, do you know how this shit works? And then he pulls out the knife, you know how this shit works? And then when he fires the rocket, how do you like how that shit works? Mm-hmm. Like, that was awesome.
You cut the Rocket Man part and just say, how do you like how that shit works?
The whole, my name's Stanley Goodspeed. Do you like the song Rocket Man? That was, oh, God, where the fuck did that come from?
Lame. And, I mean, when Nicolas Cage kills ugly Phil Pullman.
Yeah.
Right? You just get the awesome, because only Bill Pullman says it about six times in the movie. He always yells, eat this before you shoot someone.
Yeah.
I think he says, eat that, you fuck.
Yeah.
Another great villain death, you know, getting a VX pearl put in his mouth and then
smashed. Punched in the jaw.
The great slow-mo shot of what he's spewing out venom everywhere.
And spewing out liquid death.
And it's just that, you know, that everything from there until the end, the icy green smoke, and then the money shot of the explosion on the island, and the money shot of me, like, holy shit, that's Jim Caviezel. There's so much that works, and The Rock has just got all these little tiny flaws that just, you know, drag it down from being Die Hard 2 to being a little bit better than Under Siege.
Wow.
Wow.
Either you're a lot more fond of Under Siege than I am, or you really don't like The Rock.
Good job for justice.
No, I'm with you in terms of, like, the character schizophrenia, too. Like, there's a few times where Nicolas Cage drops into, like, badass ranter mode, and it feels really, atypical of his character. Like, that whole, you know, the I drive a Volvo, a beige one, and right now what I'm dealing with is one of the 10 deadliest substances the world has ever known. So how about you cut me some fucking slack? You know, it's like,
friggin',
seriously? Oh, sorry. Freaking. Yeah.
Well, I think that's Nicolas. That's Nicolas Cage. That's pure Nicolas Cage. That's all it is.
I guess.
And that's one of Bay's problems, actually, is he does have trouble controlling some of his actors.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, Jesus, he was scared shitless of Ed Harris, but can you blame him?
I don't know. The footage is on the Blu-ray, and it was on the Criterion disc, and Bay is making a noise. I don't know if he's laughing or if he's crying.
I think he's crying. I think he's
terrified. But it works, because Harris Brown is one of the greatest action movie villains ever.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to kill 70,000 people. Do you think I'm out of my fucking mind?
And I love that opening sequence, too, in Arlington, man. Like, that sequence is amazing, where, you know, like, yeah. I got to do something, Barb, something I couldn't do while you were alive. Let's hope this elevates their thinking. You know, like, that mm-hmm. scene was amazing.
Whatever happens here.
Yeah.
Where you won't think any less of me.
Yeah. Absolutely amazing sequence, and sets him
even
up brilliantly.
And Bay had said that, you know, he originally intended to shoot footage of Hummel during the wars, right?
Yeah.
The opening sequence. I think it works even better with just the absolutely fantastic Zimmer score.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The score was half Zimmer, half Mancina, but the stuff with Ed Harris's character is pure Hans Zimmer.
Yeah.
And in the background, you got the awesome opening title effect with the Rock spelled out in flame.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's the really cool, you know, you hear all the radio chatter from his career.
Yeah.
Just before the score swells up and you get the actual theme from the movie, you just everything goes on, and then you just hear this. I don't think we're not getting out of this, are we, sir?
They're not coming for us, are they, sir? Yeah, that was wicked, absolutely
and
wicked, right?
When it says that, you got this really cool up close shot of Ed Harris's eyes.
Yeah,
just it perfectly sets out everything he's going to do in that movie, and it. I was from that opening sequence. I was fucking pumped to see that movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, I saw it opening night in theater. My dad and I rented it the weekend it came out. We must have watched it 6 times. My father does not watch movies more than once. But it's just going back to it and, like, the Quentin Tarantino bullshit, the character schizophrenia. The only two characters in the movie, I should say the only character in the movie that doesn't change is Ed Harris.
Yeah, it's
I would have said Sean Connery, but that car chase sequence, you know, he goes off the deep end for a couple minutes.
Yeah. It's just, I don't know, there's so much of that movie works for me, and I'm a big fan of it. I am a big fan of The Rock. I still am. I just wish I could set it up so that whenever I put the disc in my player, I have it bookmarked so that that one scene is skipped. That, like, two chapter selects worth of scene are cut from the movie. I would be immensely satisfied.
Yeah, it's not even one of his longest movies. Just that there's the part where you can cut out.
Yeah.
There it is. Just streamline it a bit.
Yep.
And it's okay.
The Rock should have been about 80 or 90 minutes.
Yep.
And I think, like, what sucks about it really is that whole sequence to me feels like a situation where maybe they kind of knew that it didn't work, but hey, we spent all this money and did this big car chase. It's got to be on screen. You know?
And I remember at the time. At the time, I thought that was one of the coolest things I've ever seen.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm. I used to love it in high school.
Yeah,
outside of the, you know, stuff, I'm only boring your Humvee. And that's, I mean, it's a fantastically shot car chase.
Oh, yeah.
It's a great car chase. It just does, it belongs in another movie.
I think this is the point, you know, where, was this when the rumor was going around that Michael Bay was the illegitimate son of John Frankenheimer?
Yeah, that was going around for a while. He perpetuated that myth.
Yeah, and I mean, it showed because I mean, he does car chases as good as Frankenheimer.
Yeah,
but it's just it doesn't belong in there. Even when you go back and watch the trailer, the trailer's on the Blu-ray.
Yeah,
great trailer, you know, June 6th, get ready to rock. And the car chase sequences, even they don't fit in the trailer.
No, it looks like a different movie, man. It looks like a Dominic Cena movie or something.
Yeah, and the whole movie builds Cage up as like this lab rat who has no real experience, and here he is out driving all these FBI agents. He's like the only one who can keep up with them.
Yeah, in a Ferrari, a stolen Ferrari. And I got news for you. Ferraris are not that easy to drive. It doesn't work that way.
And it kind of ruins the whole evolution of Cage's character, you know, coming out of the show and at the end, you know, finally building up what it needs, you know, to kill a man, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. To get the job done.
Get out of the lab and be an FBI agent.
Yeah.
And then before that, you got him out causing $100 million worth of damage to San Francisco.
And then
he probably killed that Ferrari around.
and that fucking horrible line, too. You just fucked up your Ferrari. It isn't mine. Neither is this.
It's not mine. Listen to my acting, you probably Uncle Francis.
We do have a great Nicolas Cage line in this movie, a very cagey line. What in the name of Zeus's butthole?
yourself.
Yeah, but for every moment after that, you got something amazing, like winner should go home and fuck the prom queen.
Carla was the prom queen. Really?
Yeah.
And all that shit. This isn't combat. It's an act of lunacy. In my opinion, General Sir, I think you're a fucking idiot. Hey, that exchange
good stuff.
Was wicked, man. The whole the Thomas Jefferson quote followed up by the Oscar Wilde quote.
Oh, yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, great scenes. Some great scenes in there.
Yeah.
And that was Hensley, too, wasn't it?
That was.
Yeah.
And there's so much that works. And it really should. When the first time I saw this, again, it's like, who the hell is this Michael Bay guy?
Yeah.
Oh, this guy's got a great career ahead of him. And just it makes the flaws just that much more glaring. And with that, I think we'll shift over to our uglies.
Oh. Here we go. Hang on to your butts.
Do that.
Okay. Matt, are you ready?
All right. I got to go with Pearl Harbor.
Oh.
Steve, I'm sorry. I hear what you're saying about what you like about it. Confession, I did not see the director's cut. I saw the theatrical cut. This is his other movie I hadn't seen until this week. And I heard all the bad hype about it. I've heard how much hate it's gotten over the years. And normally when I have that much lowered expectations for a movie, I'll end up liking it. It'll, you know, I try to approach it objectively. I actually enjoyed John Carpenter's Village of the Damned for that reason. I had fun with X-Men Origins Wolverine. It's because of lowered expectations.
Oh,
this
wow.
one, yeah. But this one, I couldn't get into. It's, again, the show business side of it. It's trying so hard to recreate Titanic. And you can see, you know, we have a real-life situation. Let's make it a movie by throwing a romance in front of it. And again, I understand that may have been studio insistence, but one of the big cliches I have a problem with – it's more of just an element in movies. It's a big problem. It's a bigger problem than Michael Bay. But it's like I don't care if fictional people date each other. And it's something you see added as a subplot to so many movies. Just have two characters meet and fall in love, and there just has to be some – you know, some meat to those stories, and I didn't get these characters. I didn't connect to these characters at all, and it just struck me as such a tacked-on romance that I did not care about whatsoever. And then that's the first hour and it's about the first hour, maybe even in the first hour and a half before the combat starts. And I'm watching this movie. It's a three-hour movie. It's Bay's longest movie.
Yep.
I'm an hour into it. I took a break from the movie to go do the dishes. movies are supposed to be an escape from reality.
Who wants to do dishes?
I'm doing the dishes as an escape from the movie. That's bad. And, like, I got to see the director's cut, see, you know, how that's rebalanced. But at that point, it was so much. It was such a slow, boring, dull plot.
Mm.
And, you know, Bay's not a great filmmaker in general, but his other movies – they held my attention for a while. This one, I was watching the clock. This one was a real chore, and I didn't like this movie at all. And yeah, it's pretty much what I got now. It's just a romance tacked on to, you know, a real event. And it's like, this is a case where you really need the characters to mean something. And without that, you have nothing. You have an empty movie.
And that's true. That is true. I mean, I'm a little less, I'm a romantic. I mean, I'll freely admit it. I am a romantic, you know, like I love sitting down and watching a good romance drama kind of thing when it's handled well. And no, Pearl Harbor didn't handle it well, but it didn't handle it any worse than three quarters of the movies that came out in 1950s Hollywood either.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I chose it as my ugly too, but on the other end, I didn't get around to watching Transformers 2 and 3, so my judgment might be flawed.
Yeah, you are. You're definitely.
But yeah, I mean, to me, like I said before, it's basically, like, I had the same reaction to Titanic. After an hour, I was like, okay, this is enough. I'm bored. This hasn't catch my interest at all. And while Titanic has Billy Zane, Pearl Harbor has Josh Hartnett as the horrible actor of the group.
Danny, you can't die. You're going to be a father. No rape. You are.
But to me, like, it just really felt like such a missed opportunity. Because I can see, like, what Bay was shooting for that old school old Hollywood feeling, and the way he shoots it is really nice. It looks like a Technicolor picture, you know.
It is a gorgeous looking movie.
But he just can't quite capture it and can't make the love story interesting to grab you. To get you into that movie, because I would be all in for an epic romance movie if it worked, you know. But it doesn't, and the dialogue's pretty bad too in general. I think earlier when they meet Cute, he's like, oh, my nose is hurting. No, I think that's your heart. Barf.
No, yeah, I forgot about that. Thank you so much.
But yeah, it is really too long and not that interesting. To me, it's not really an ugly. It's not really a bad either. It's just like a meh, a big huge meh. I could do without this. It's a movie for me that's just there. You know, it doesn't grab you or anything. It doesn't evoke anything to me. It's not even good. It's not even bad enough to warrant hatred, you know?
It just is.
Yeah, exactly.
I do. I mean, like I said, I still feel that the hatred is entirely unjustified. You know, it's too innocuous to hate it, you know? It's just one of those movies that... And Titanic is much the same. I mean, Titanic gets so much hate because it's the biggest movie of all time, you know? And similar to Avatar, you know, it's just hype totally kills it. Hype draws the cynics out in droves, you know? But I think that's Pearl Harbor's biggest thing. It's just the hype for that movie was so huge before it came out, and the trailers were great. I mean, it had some fantastic trailers. And I think what people saw just wasn't what they expected, you know?
Yeah. I still can't get why Titanic was so huge either, so, you know, I'm totally out of this mindset.
Yeah. Like a lot of these movies, even Titanic, a lot of these movies are, in and of themselves, they're kind of innocuous. They're not really that horrible.
No.
Or that good.
Exactly.
And it's when a movie becomes so successful, it's expected to be an extremely good movie. And if it doesn't meet that, then it's judged on it doesn't deserve the success as opposed to, you know, is it objectively in and of itself good or bad?
Mm hmm.
And I think the other thing with that, the other trend that I've seemed to notice, I call it, you know, Kevin Smith / Joss Whedon syndrome. If you listen to all the noise about Kevin Smith and Joss Whedon, you'd think they're the two biggest directors of all time. Mm-hmm. You know, you think they're the biggest celebrity filmmakers in existence. And I find a lot of these same people, there's a lot of crossover in how vocal, how loud the noise is around movies like Titanic and Pearl Harbor and Avatar. And, you know, like, all these big budget Hollywood crowd pleasers, you know. It's a vocal minority. I mean, like Mercer said earlier, Pearl Harbor made, what, over $500 million worldwide. So people went to see this movie, you know. But it's not these people that are bitching and moaning about it. It's not the people who paid $500 million, you know.
Even at that time, I mean, the internet community wasn't so huge and influent as it is today. And even back then, what I heard wasn't good about Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
You know? But it didn't deserve any, you know, like a 2 on 10 or anything, you know. It's more like a 5 or something.
Yeah. Exactly. What's next on the block? What's next on the chopping block here?
I think it's you, Steve.
It's me? Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, God. If there isn't ugly in Michael Bay's body of work, it must...
Did you want to hear... Before you do this,
I think I need to take a pull on something. Or if there isn't ugly in Michael Bay's body of work, it must be Bad Boys. It has to be the original Bad Boys. That movie is the most incomprehensible mess of ridiculousness that I've ever seen in my life. It made like a lot of the direct-to-video shit that I've reviewed for DVD Verdict look like Die Hard. You know, it was the most horribly shot, horribly acted, horribly written, ridiculously long, just boneheaded exercise in absolute futility that I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
It was a horrible, 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 horrible movie. It was just... I can't even call it a movie. It was a piece of poop in a film can, is what that movie It was just Will Smith in a billowing silk shirt, and he used the same cut over and over and over at the end towards the end during the chase sequence where Will is chasing after Checky Cario or whoever it was, and you know, all you see is him running down white stairwells with a billowing silk shirt with a gun in his hand, and like he even pans the camera from right to left. Right to left, right to left, over Will Smith with a billowing silk shirt. You know, it's just like, oh my God! Oh! The pacing was so horrible. Like, nothing happens in this movie for 90 minutes, and then there's a shootout at an airplane hangar, and then the movie's over.
Basically, it's like a cop movie built around a Three's Company episode.
It's a cop movie with a ridiculously preposterous plot and logic gaps, like the gaps in logic in this movie. That make, you know, spoofs. It makes the Naked Gun movies look like the French Connection. It's ridiculous.
And Pagliano is the dumbest dumb captain in film history.
Oh, my God. It was just... Oh.
And he doesn't even try to take anyone's badge and gun.
No, he never does. And, you know, leaving a federal witness handcuffed in a car and stuff, which, I mean, you know, yeah, they did it to Joe Pesci in Lethal Weapon, but this was Lethal Weapon, you know, and it was Joe Pesci.
Are you going to tell Raisin Murdoch not to do it?
And, like, we got a witness. She just witnessed a murder. Here, pretend to be Mike. Pretend, because she'll only talk to Mike. Hi, I'm Mike Lowry. Yes, my fucking God. Martin Lawrence needs to die. Could you please just snort a few more lines of coke and go jogging in the summer again? Please? Oh, my God, you're horrible and I hate you.
There are two good points I'll give to Bad Boys, and that Stella Leone looks hot. And
she looks hot, but it's like that hot chick who, when you talk to her then, she speaks like Beatrice from the bingo parlor with a list. She's got that much air in her head in that movie that she makes Martin Lawrence look intelligent. It's just like, and oh my God!
There's that, and there's that chick. Cario is fucking badass.
Oh, he's horrible! He's absolutely terrible!
I thought he was pretty fearsome in that one.
Oh, man. Well, I know why Gabe likes him. Gabe likes him because they actually had a character with a French accent who sounded... But, man, I am not your fucking chemistry teacher. Oh, my... Like, he was just...
You fucked with my timetable.
You fucked with my timetable. Oh, my God. He was absolutely terrible. He didn't even need to be in the film. The film didn't need a villain.
Do it! Come on! Jimmy!
The only good thing I can say for Bad Boys, the only positive I will give it, is it showed the world that Will Smith could be a badass.
Yeah.
You know, it did show the world that the Fresh Prince had more up his sleeve than West Philadelphia born and raised, you know? And I'll give it that, but the movie was just such a collection of mental deficiency that...
I always like the Hangar Shootout.
The Hangar Shootout was, I mean, well, it was a Michael Bay action sequence, but it was an early Michael Bay action sequence, so there's some good stuff there, there's some good bits, but it's like watching one of those old John Woo movies where he didn't have the budget to really pull off what he wanted to do, like the end of The Killer, like the church shootout at the end of The Killer. You know, it's a great shootout. It's really well filmed, like it really well, I can't even say well filmed, well mounted. It's beautifully choreographed, but the low budget kind of betrays it a little bit.
But it ain't The Gauntlet.
Yeah, it ain't The Gauntlet from Hard Boiled, you know, and that was my problem with Bad Boys. Like that shootout, yeah, there's some good meat in that shootout, but it just, it doesn't feel like a cohesive whole. It feels like, okay, now we're going to shoot a guy getting blown out of the door of his plane. Okay, now we're going to shoot a guy doing this. Like, it feels like the action is too stenciled, like too just stapled together.
Also, it must be noted, one of the drug dealers in the movie, his name is Noah Trafficante.
That's pure genius.
Oh, my. But it was just, oh, God, you know, I had seen, the last time I had seen Bad Boys was in the VHS days. It was a long time ago.
And did you remember liking it?
I remembered liking it, and I saw it after The Rock. Like, I'd seen it, like, when I saw The Rock, and, hey, Michael Bay, okay, cool, let's track down another Michael Bay movie, Bad Boys. And I'm pretty sure that when we watched it, we were under the influence of something, because it was that time in my life where 9 chances out of 10 I was under the influence of something because of The Wake. So, but, like, when I watched it, it was just... oh, man, like, and someone had convinced me to buy it on Blu-ray. I'm not sure who it was. I don't know if it was you, John, or if it was Brian, but whoever it is, the next time I see him, I'm setting him on fire. But anyway.
It was Brian.
Yeah. Okay.
It was totally Brian.
Well, the next time I
see him. I have an aversion to being on fire.
But it was.
Yeah, it's a tough movie for me to.
I'll tell you what. If you ever want to give it another try, we'll smoke some Mad Chronic and then.
But then I'll be afraid that Will Smith will come and arrest me or something.
No, what am I saying? We'll smoke some Mad Chronic, reach for Bad Bulls, and Big Trouble in Little China is on the shelf.
Big Trouble in Little China, yes, exactly. Or Hot Fuzz.
I'm kind of in a similar boat. Like in high school, I loved this movie. I mean, high school Matt loves action movies prior to, you know, being all crazy in the movies. Like, this is a movie I saw so many times, like so many times in high school. I used to love this movie. And I watched it to the point where I didn't like it anymore. I watched it into the ground. So it's hard for me to watch it objectively now. I almost wish I can get that back. And it's not coming back. But, like, I remember really liking it a lot of action movies at the time.
It's like me in the original Delta Force.
Oh, I remember that one. Yep.
Yeah, and that's the thing with me, I mean, it's like I remember owning it on VHS. I remember having a copy of it on VHS that was probably only watched once, you know. But I remember thinking, okay, that wasn't so bad, you know, like that was pretty good. That was enjoyable. I know now why everybody liked it, you know, that kind of thing. But when I went back last week and I put it on, it was just like, how in the name of all that is holy did anybody ever like this movie? This is a horrible, horrible, horrible movie. And Sarah came down and she's like, oh, you're watching Bad Boys. Yes, and it fucking sucks.
And she went upstairs and started to cry.
She went upstairs and started watching NCIS again, I guess.
You're going to judge Bad Boys and your wife watches NCIS.
My wife is an NCIS junkie. She got a thing for Leroy Jethro Gibbs, man. Leave her alone.
All right, John, what's your ugly?
C equal to Steve's ugly.
You're ugly.
Badder Boys.
What, Bad Boys 2?
Bad Boys 2.
Well, that was way better than the first one, man.
Oh, yeah.
A big pile of shit 8 years in the making. I haven't gone back to Bad Boys, so I'll... I can't join in on a lot of the venom. Bad Boys 2 was not only garbage, it was 2.5 hours of garbage.
That's why I love it. No, I have no excuse.
I want to talk about, you know, The Rock. For everything right it does two things wrong, you know? Bad Boys for every cool little moment. Okay, there's an awesome car chase in it.
Amazing car chase.
Yeah, there's that great shootout in the Jamaican's house. I love the spino cam when it goes through the walls in that scene.
Yeah.
Okay? I can even get past the way the Haitians are talking. Because that's not what Haitians sound like. Haitians don't sound like retards.
Man, we are not getting a humanitas this year.
Doobly 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 blondie dread. So they go after the Haitians. The guys sound like the characters on Bill and Ben Flowerpot Men. The devil is not welcome in my house. I kept waiting, hoping and praying that, you know, either the Jamaican voodoo posse or El Scorpio from Predator, all of a sudden their war was going to explode through the walls and kill the Haitians.
But it never happened, did it?
It never happened. No, but even with as horrible as those characters were, that shootout was cool. And, you know, Bad Boys 2 is – Bay has actually become an even – he's a solid action director.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Who should never, ever be allowed to do comedy.
Yep.
And I say that even after seeing, you know, the Pain and Gain trailer and thinking it looks amazing.
I think I do think Pain and Gain looks great. I really do.
Yeah. You know, Pain and Gain looks like just another example as to why Mark Wahlberg should stick to comedy.
Yeah.
Because it works for it.
He should never again make another movie like Contraband, ever.
Yeah. But no, I'm watching Bad Boys 2, and it's just, there's so much poop being flung at screen. and that's what it feels like. It feels like Michael Bay went to a high school and asked all the students to write him an action movie, and then he just started ripped all the pages out. You know, threw them up in the air, and then threw 144 of them together and said, this is going to be my movie. it's crazy. You know, you've got, Gabe said it earlier, you know, you've got Will Smith is bumping uglies with Martin Lawrence's sister. Who's an undercover cop? Who's being, you know, used as bait by her ambitious, or her, having her ambitions turned against her by her superiors, because, you know, it's a pretty girl who can probably sink her in deep cover. And then, you know, you got the, we're going to mount up now, we're going to hit the bad guy's mansion, this is going to be a really cool shootout to close the movie. No, fuck you, we're going to Cuba.
On a Coast Guard Blackhawk.
To me, it's like Michael Bay, if he did Domino, it's Bad Boys 2.
That's Bay directing Bad Boys 2 wishes that he had the reservations that Tony Scott had when he was filming Domino.
Complete with the cave, crazy hallucination desert scene.
He's trying to make like this thick movie. He's trying to put all these little subplots into it, and it's just a disaster. He can't manage it. He needs to make these short and sweet 90-minute action movies. That's what these all need to be, and they're all half the problems are fixed.
Anything that you liked about the characters in the original ones, those characters don't exist anymore.
The characters didn't exist in the first one, man. The characters, there were no characters in the first one.
Okay, it's like we've got retarded Haitians, you know, instead of the police captain now, instead of being incompetent, has Down syndrome.
Oh, God.
And Diablo is horrible.
I hope nobody listens to this episode.
No,
I think doesn't every line that Joey Pantoliano say has to do about having brass up his ass or something? He's always talking about somebody being up his ass.
I got the chief up my ass. I got the commissioner up my ass.
I don't care who's up your Hershey Highway.
It was a bad movie, though.
It was terrible. It was absolutely terrible. You know, the villain, horrible. You want to complain about Jackie Cario?
Mm-hmm.
Johnny Tapia? Garbage.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely, he was very weak villain.
Not even weak. The guy doesn't even know, what he wants to play, you know? Mm-hmm. Is he supposed to be intimidating? Is he supposed to be funny? You know, the guy's supposed to be the biggest drug dealer in Miami. Miami, okay? This is a You've seen some of the villains on Miami Vice. Right? This guy's supposed to be the biggest drug dealer in the fucking drug gateway of the biggest country in the world, and he's an idiot. You know, he's got a house full of rats that are eating all of his money, and a fat little girl who wants to wrestle like a princess.
That's why business, I love it.
And his business partners are the most stereotypical Russians ever.
Can you believe that Ron Shelton is credited as a screenwriter on this movie?
That's hilarious.
And if I have to give it one thing over the original, at least the score every 2 seconds wasn't bum 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 bum.
What I like about it over the original is the action is actually more present throughout the entire film instead of just rear loaded. There's no really, really, really fucking terrible, inane subplot that just leads you meandering for half the movie's runtime.
No, there's six subplots. None of them have enough added to them to actually be full subplots.
Yeah, but you can just ignore them and wait for the next act.
We forgot to mention the sequence where they're in the morgue and Martin Lawrence sides with the dead chick.
That was absolutely horrible.
Well, I mean,
any time the camera is on Martin Lawrence instead of Will Smith, the movie is terrible.
I was kind of hoping that the rumors that were floating around were true about them doing Bad Boys 3 and Martin Lawrence having no interest in it. And they were like, apparently, the rumor that was floating around for a while was that it was going to be Will Smith and Terrence Howard. And that would have been badass.
Okay. If it's not Iron Man Terrence Howard, if it's full on, you know, Hustle and Flow badass Terrence Howard, I'd be down for that.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's hard out here for a pimp when he's shooting motherfuckers. But yeah, no, and Bad Boys 2 was just, you know, for a movie that was 8 years in the making, because, I mean, there had been a rumored sequel to this, I think, pretty much following Armageddon.
Even before then, dude, I remember reading about Bad Boys 2 when Bad Boys was still riding high.
Yeah.
You know?
I can still remember all the rumors. I think it was called Bad Around the World, and it was them, you know, like this globe-trotting adventure with international terrorists and everything. I'm glad that movie didn't get made.
Oh, my God, yeah, don't be talking.
The same era that gave us Rush Hour.
But yeah, I laughed all the way through Bad Boys 2. I have no excuse.
I was making fun of that earlier. I actually cherish that. You know, getting nuts by this car. Not this one, because I'm going to fuck this one up. I like that. Right? I mean, there's some, you know, as much as we make fun of the Cuba sequence, you know, the amount of carnage on screen is awe-inspiring.
And the villain death is great.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's fantastic. Yeah. Tapped in the head, and then he falls on a landmine.
Awesome.
And Bad Boys 2 is gory as all shit.
Mm-hmm.
So when he falls on that landmine, you know, there's Sam Raimi levels of goop that splatter up on the floor. I'm pretty sure it makes a slurping noise when he explodes.
It sounds like someone's sticking their hands in Jell-O.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm not going to go out there and say in any way it's a good movie.
No.
No.
And it's one of the last things I'll reach for on the show. You know, I'll grab Cobra before I grab Bad Boys 2.
Oh, yeah. Cobra.
Actually, to hell with it, you know what? I would watch Commando willingly before I'll reach for Bad Boys 2.
John, I think you should take some medication and lie down. I really do.
I think I should get some steam.
Oh, Commando. Oh. There are men shooting at me with AK-47s. I'll hide behind these bulletproof flower boxes that can only go up to my knees.
Speaking of that, you and Mark Lester.
That's why that movie's awesome.
Commando is the movie that Gabriel's been talking about Bad Boys 2 this whole time. It's the ironic.
Shit, I thought we were talking about the movie where Arnold Schwarzenegger's daughter gets kidnapped and she's played by that chick from Who's the Boss?
You mean that little boy from Who's the Boss?
Little boy from Who's the Boss?
It's like, you know, when... No, we didn't do an episode on David Fincher.
Not yet.
Why do I keep thinking I've had a conversation with somebody about Panic Room where I talk about Jodie Foster and Macaulay Culkin?
Oh, my God.
Oh, man.
We're getting shut down. Michael Staley's going to phone us, and he's going to be, you guys are not doing another episode.
Yeah, so the U.S. State Department call. You're not allowed in the country ever.
We're extraditing you.
Yeah, and Matt Avrek's being deported. I hope you got room in Newfoundland for Matt.
Matt, you can rent an apartment in Halifax.
Oh, God. I like cold weather.
Hey, we're hiring at work.
All right.
Any closing thoughts on the on Biotic Evil?
I think if there is, you know, that the filmmaking equivalent, and I don't mean, I mean metaphorically speaking, not literally speaking, if there is the filmic equivalent of, you know, the golden tanned white shirt wearing beach bum with the sunglasses and the oily suntan lotion all over him who goes around kicking over other people's sandcastles, then it is Michael Bay.
So Michael Bay is the Hulk Hogan of directors?
No, I wouldn't say he's the more like the beach bully of directors. Like Michael Bay
is an orange goblin.
When I think of Michael Bay, I automatically picture like a guy with a sweater tied around his neck, wearing a pair of sunglasses, driving around in a convertible Ferrari for some reason. I just
With your tennis racket.
When you think of Michael Bay, you think of a villain from a Beverly Hills Cop movie.
Yes.
You think of Stan Gable from Revenge of the Nerds.
An alpha beta.
He's an alpha beta. Yeah.
He's totally an alpha. Yes. Yes.
But yeah, no, I think, you know, for all the shit that the guy gets, I think he actually really is a competent filmmaker, and I think that when he's got a script...
I think he's a movie fan in general.
I think he is a movie fan, and I think when he's got a script that works in his favor, I think that he can really churn out a great product. And I think, like, The Island is a prime example of that. The Island, like, as a movie, pretty much works the entire way through, you know? There's stuff that I feel doesn't entirely fit, like, the action sequences and stuff like that, but when you sit down and watch that movie as a whole, when you remove it from... You know, like, my preconceived notions going in, like, I had visions of THX 1138 and stuff floating around in my head. But when I sat down and watched, like, you sit down and watch that without thinking of these other movies that inspired it. And on its own, The Island works pretty well. You know, you can't really take too much away from that movie. And some of his other stuff, like, I mean, the first Transformers, again, I know, Matt, you and I got our differences on that one. But I think that movie, for what it is, taken in a vacuum, going in without any preconceived notions about Transformers and Cybertron and Starscream and The Matrix and all of this crap, you go in and you sit down and watch that movie without, like, watch it in a vacuum, and I think it works pretty well, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that's the best way to look at Bay is to treat his movies in a vacuum, you know? Don't try to compare, don't sit down and compare Bad Boys to Lethal Weapon, because that's not going to end well, you know? But
and something that you have to give to Bay is that Pearl Harbor accepted. He seems to have a genuine fun, you know, doing these movies.
Yeah,
And you feel the joy coming out of them that he's finding this entertaining, and he does have an incredible eye.
He does. I mean, like as far as his action goes, and I mean, people can bitch and moan about fast cuts and all that all they want, and how, you know, all he uses is oranges and blues because those are the two most recognizable colors of the human eye and blah, 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 you know, whatever. You know, that is absolutely pointless. You might as well bitch at Walt Disney for making Mickey Mouse's robes red in Fantasia so he'd stand out on screen. You know, like, give me a break, man. Give me a break. You're trashing, you're not just trashing Michael Bay as a director, then you're trashing the very concepts behind crafting a film.
Mm-hmm.
When you get into bashing them for this kind of stuff, you know, it's petty and it's stupid. It's
he always said his three biggest influences: George Lucas, Steven Spielberg, James Cameron.
Yep.
And you can see it there on screen.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
And look, I mean, you look at those fat cuts, and those action scenes aren't that hard to follow. You know, I mean, geographically.
Yeah.
And stuff.
No, for me, it's the same as you look at, okay, not to go back into Spielberg territory again, but Saving Private Ryan, you look at the opening sequence of Saving Private Ryan and how often that has been imitated, that first a half hour of carnage, you know? No other director, and even like, even some of my very favorite directors have done stuff kind of inspired by Saving Private Ryan, that whole herky-jerky documentary cam, gritty film effects and stuff. No other director has been able to do that same thing and keep it comprehensible. Like Spielberg did with Private Ryan, or Bay does with his action scenes. You know, like, yes, everything is fast-paced. Yes, the camera is all over the place, but your focal point is still front and center. He still has a focal point for the action. And as much as I hate to say it, because, I mean, the man is my favorite director, you take Ridley Scott, you take the opening sequence of Gladiator. It's a beautiful sequence. That big battle scene, that nine-minute-long battle scene in Gladiator is gorgeous, absolutely stunning to look at, but it is chaotic as all hell. And there is no real focal point. You get little bits and pieces, little snippets, but it doesn't follow the action like, say, to the opening of Saving Private Ryan did. And Bay is able to do that. Bay is able.
Or like what Nolan tried to do in the first in Batman Begins.
Yes,
you
exactly.
Know?
You know, there's no focal point for the action. There's nothing there for you to draw your eye. So you lose it. You lose focus. And Bay is – he's able to keep your focus. He's able to really keep you – like, yes, it's fast. Yes, it's chaotic. But you still know what's going on because he keeps you focused on the action, you know?
One thing I love that Bay does, actually, he did it really well in Armageddon, and there's a fantastic shot of it in Pearl Harbor when the Arizona goes up. Just before he does one of his great big explosions, there's almost like a sound of oxygen being sucked out of a room. Everything goes dead quiet for a second just to catch your focus.
Yeah, and you really get that point of impact. That like it's that dramatic explanation point, you know?
Yeah, he does that quite often. I think there's a car crash, too, in Bad Boys 2, where you're going back and they're about to crash through a window, like, from the inside. And then he moves the camera from the outside, and you wait, like, 3 seconds, and then it crashes.
Sorry.
Steve agrees.
Well, darn cats.
Jesus. Anyway.
Yeah, with Bay, like he's not the greatest director, but a lot of the resentment comes from him being like the most successful. He makes these super huge blockbusters that end up being like some of the most successful movies ever, and he doesn't really deserve that. But taking it in of himself, he can be a lot of fun. You know, he has some flaws. I think he has some problems, but he's not that bad.
Yeah, he's like, you know, he's like the rich kid that lives down the street that everybody else in the neighborhood hates because his dad drives a Ferrari.
Yeah. Yeah.
He might be a nice kid, but you'd never know because everybody hates him.
I want to love the commercial. That shows me he's willing to make fun of himself.
Yeah, yeah.
His Verizon commercial?
Yeah. That was absolutely fantastic.
I'm director Michael Bay, and I demand things that are awesome.
What was it? Awesome Kitty?
Awesome Kitty. There's a tiger. Yeah. Awesome Barbecue.
Yeah. He's the man.
He personifies Flash.
He yeah, exactly.
The man is 100% style.
Yeah. Even more so than, like, you know, you get other guys like Tony Scott and these guys who really come from the same vein. Like, I mean, Bay, without Tony Scott, Michael Bay would never exist.
No.
You know, and no. Scott was the prototype, and Bay lacked certain sensibilities that Scott had. Like, Scott always had that.
Tony Scott was the original, you know, original go-to guy for Simpson and Bruckner.
Yeah, he was. But
he was the director for biggest hits.
He always had that thoughtfulness behind his pictures. Like, you know, and that little bit of stuff he gets from Ridley, that whole the ponderous nature of the Scott brothers, you know, like there's always a question behind their movies. No matter how lightweight it may be, there's still a purpose there. And Bay doesn't always have that drive. Bay just wants to entertain, you know?
Bay could never do Men on Fire.
No, never, never. Or Enemy of the State would be something that's just out of Bay's grasp entirely. You know? True Romance, for God's sake. it couldn't happen. But I can definitely see the similarities between the two.
Yeah, definitely.
It's just where Scott worked more as an entertainer, he still kind of had those sensibilities that that intelligence, that intellect in there. Even
he still saw the, he still went after the artistic side of filmmaking.
Even though he was making crowd pleasers, he tried to put a little bit of intellect into it. Whereas Bay just makes crowd pleasers, you know.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with that.
No,
no,
you know. You want fantastic summer entertainment, look no further than a Michael Bay film.
I just wish he'd get away from the Transformers stuff.
I
wish he'd go back to just doing Michael Bay films.
Well, it's nice to see that he's doing Pain and Gain coming out this summer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it definitely looks like a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. I look forward to it.
And I totally think he should have directed G.I. Joe.
I agree.
Yeah.
So who are we doing next week?
Next week we're doing another 360 or whatever 180 degrees turn and going to a guy who likes to probe the deeper recess of the human mind, and that is Mr. Paul Schrader.
Dun dun dun.
Mostly known for directing American Gigolo Autofocus and the Cat People remake, as well as writing some of Martin Scorsese's pictures.
Wasn't his big one, what was it? Hardcore.
Hardcore, yeah.
Yeah.
He's got a couple of memorable movies, so it should be an interesting, if very different, ride than Michael Bay.
I guess all that's left to say is...
see you next Wednesday. Kaboom!
Thanks, everyone.